Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Spanish yield spread widening. Earnings season kicking off, a big week ahead. China's GDP disappoints big time. And our guest, Ed Easterling today. All this and lots more on episode 259 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the week of April 16th, 2012. Well, thanks for joining me. Andrew Horowitz here. We have a lot to talk about today because there is lots happening in the news, lots happening that you need to know about. And of course, we have earnings season that is not only underway starting on Monday, but it's big time. 91 of the 500 stocks in the S&P 500 are going to be reporting. It's like one-fifth of all of it, and we're really going to get down and dirty into what the expectations are compared to what the reality is, and of course, the outlook, because you have to look at not only what the earnings came in at compared to what analysts thought, but also compared to what it was maybe on a two-month basis average, what analysts thought was going to happen, and more importantly, what management thinks for the outlook. We'll get into that in a second. Lots to talk about, like I mentioned here, and a great guest. I want to mention some of the things that are going on in the markets to keep you abreast of what's happening, why it's happening, and what you may see into the future. How to get you prepared for the inevitable, so to speak, of whether we're going to see maybe a little bit of a correction here continuing, or if in fact we're going to see a very, very shallow type of drop, dip, slowdown, and then a big recovery moving forward. Because right now, we're really in the heart of the decision-making process by a lot of managers and institutions of whether or not they're going to commit more money to these markets on an equity basis. And so far, what we've seen in the earnings season is that while we've had a few companies report, and some of them, if not all of them, a little bit better than expectations, if you saw any kind of, any kind of misstep. Look what happened with Infosys last week, an Indian company that is, I guess we could say, is like an IBM in the consulting and service area. They really just got obliterated when the earnings didn't come in. And one of the things that we're seeing right now is the hangover, of course, from what has gone on with the austerity measures in Europe. Unfortunately, a lot of those measures are falling short in terms of the economies there, trying to firm up their overall sovereign debt issue, even though we had that gigantic trillion-dollar LTRO just a few months ago. It seems that a lot of that is really starting to dissipate. A lot of the add-on effect that we saw, the bonds of the banks and of the sovereigns really getting a lot better, a lot more sturdy, a lot more backing, a lot more investors looking to put money in there and finding that there's some safety in that. Great returns from those bonds this year. All of a sudden, we're seeing a hiccup. What we're going to talk about right now is what's happening and where the problems are. If you look at Spain, the biggest issue right now was that their bonds, and when you look at the bonds there, you look at the bond spreads compared to German, because that's their core. And what you're seeing is that in Spain, the bonds there, the sovereign bonds, are really ratcheting higher. In other words, their yields are going up. And in comparison to Germany, which means their bonds are dropping. And already the Spanish government is asking the ECB to help out to buy their bonds. I mean, we're talking about only, a couple of months later after this LTRO was done, that Spain is now looking essentially for a bailout of sorts. We'll call it a mini bailout of the ECB to come in and buy their bonds because it's not being picked up in the open markets very well. Their bond auctions that have gone on have not seen the kind of, confidence vote, that we can call it, that you would expect to see in the region when you have the backing of the ECB. And that's a bad thing. And you're seeing this spike actually not only in Spain, but also in Italy and Portugal as well. Now, to put this in context, I think this is the important thing. Why are investors worried about this? And side note, The Spanish equity markets are down 15% this year. In the last several weeks, the last 4 weeks have been down weeks for Europe overall, and their markets are down about 12% in that period of time. So we're not, you know, kind of seeing any kind of just small situation brewing again, but now all of a sudden it starts to widen. And if Greece was a big issue for markets, Spain is a gigantic intergalactic problem. Their numbers of their markets and their bond offerings and issues they have outstanding, the debt load that they have is just dramatically larger than it is in Greece. Now, when you have that kind of situation happen and you have the continuation of the contagion, uncontained, let's call it, well, you have a big problem here because there's only so much money you can really bleed out of the IMF and the ECB. In fact, there's a meeting this week that's going to go on, and there's, I'll call it a begging meeting, hoping that the rest of the world will help bail out Europe. And, you know, we haven't seen this, so this may sound silly, but so far there's been no limit as to how much the world, or the IMF kicked back a little bit. There's no limit as to how much they'll be put into the Eurozone. The euro is still over 130, although it came down significantly over the last few weeks. But yet at the same time, you have to realize that there's going to be an end to this somewhere. Now, hopefully, they'll be able to hold out long enough, be able to push money into the system long enough to actually get this thing resolved. But until then, we're going to continue to see the after effects, the knock-ons. And that's what's happening with markets right now, on top of the fact that we're seeing a lot of negative surprises when it comes to economics in not only the United States, but in China and around the world. We saw the Economic Surprise Index, which we talked about several times. We put it on the website over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And that is really something you need to pay attention to, because it's sloping down hard and the markets have not adjusted properly to really make up the differential looking forward as to what the economics are showing. The jobs numbers that came in last week, the initial claims at 380 was very disheartening. CPI was rising a bit. And when you look at this, it's starting to back the Fed, our Fed, into a corner with the inability to really do much because inflation is starting to kick up. Their jobs numbers haven't, they've helped things, but really that's because of the labor participation rate. A lot of fanfare going on with regard to, oh, the jobs numbers, the unemployment rate's at 8.2, and we'll see it probably closer to 8 by the election. But remember, this is more of a pandering, a rhetoric. This is electoral, political type of commentary that's coming out. But really, when you get down and look at the statistics, roll up your sleeves and kind of scope out what's going on, let's be honest, it's really a big factor of just the statistical anomalies that are dealt with when it comes to the numbers, and then relating them back to the labor participation rate, the lack of people that are in the labor markets right now. So we're going to watch this earnings season, but really what we have to look at is what management is going to say, if they're going to confirm also that what they're seeing in the U.S. is better, but at the same time, how much they're affected by European and Asian slowdowns. So I mentioned that we are in a market downtrend. In fact, our market trend indicator that we track, which is three components that go into this, is in a strong downtrend. We go from strong downtrend, to an uptrend, to a strong uptrend. Four different levels at that. And last week, we broke down two levels to the lowest we have, which is a strong downtrend, and that was confirmed, I think it was on Tuesday, and then we saw those two up days, which was interesting, just a kind of a snapback. But low volume days, we came in on Thursday for our clients of our managed growth strategy, and we really hit the shorts pretty hard. We have a put option on the S&P 500, as well as we utilized a small cap inverse ETF and really pumped it hard on Thursday afternoon when we saw that the rise in the markets was really not anything more than, it looked like futures driven, not a lot of volume that came in, very little participation with that. The levels that came up right to the 50-day moving average and then popped right off it on the downside, that was not good. Now, we'll see a lot of that, the big fight over the 50-day moving average. This is a big area that you need to really pay attention to. We wrote a piece about this on Friday, that managers will basically pull the button or push the button, pull the trigger. They're going to look for the 50-day line as a line in the sand, a demarcation point, which they will just simply and really mindlessly try to hold. It's a big thing not only on the index, but it's also on an individual stock. You got the 50-day moving average, which is very important. It's a key institutional level. Don't ask me why. It just is. And when you'll see is that when you get near that point, you're going to see it popping above, popping below. And once you see one side win, it starts to get a little bit ugly. You see what's called pop stops. My friend Corey Rosenblum talks about that a lot. Pop stops, both on the short side and long side. So you're going to see the breakdown of sell stops. You're going to see the breakdown of buy stops, depending on which side of the 50-day moving average you're on. And right now we're below it on the S&P 500 and below it on the Dow Jones as well. These are key levels that you need to pay attention to. It starts making managers nervous. And when you see managers nervous, they start kicking up their selling or their buying, and that's what really moves markets. Remember, institutions really are the key players when it comes to markets. So we know that there's a lot of problems happening in Spain. We also know that we saw that the GDP for China was very disappointing last week. That's what really kicked off the much greater emphasis on selling. They came in at 8.1. Expectations were about 8.2, 8.3. Last period was 8.9. So we're seeing a full almost 1% reduction in GDP compared to last quarter. That's big. Where's the problem? Is it China? Is it their, you know, as Geithner and all the gang over here would talk about, they have to change their yuan band for their currency. What is it? Well, as far as we can tell, it's very simple. It's the fact that Europe's on austerity and they're not buying things, and that's really throwing a monkey wrench into China. We even saw Apple, oh my gosh, sell off 2.5% on Friday. We talked about this last week. The title of the podcast last week in episode number 258 was simple. Change of trend, and is Apple's trend over? Is Apple starting to roll? At the time, it wasn't. It really was, so far we've had one day really of any kind of significant down on Apple. But you need to watch this. You have a lot of things that are coming to play right now, and is the market for Apple phones, for example, saturated? Is the world, did they overshoot? Did we see too much of a bullish call back in, let's say, mid-January? In the beginning, it was one thing, but then we really started to see markets ramp up and people get very giddy. So the VIX head down below 15, which is really a very low number when it comes to the VIX and a real big sign of complacency. You know, they say the hardest times to buy or sell are when there's a lot of fear. Did you fear going short at 15 when the market was there? It would have been the right move. Do you fear going long when the VIX was at 45, let's say? It was probably the right move. Right now we're showing that the Spearman indicator is showing a bit of an oversold indication. This is big picture stuff, right? Not absolute, but big picture. Put all the pieces of the puzzle together. We're seeing the McClellan way down, again, in a position that you're probably going to see a relief rally sometime in the beginning of next week, depending on if you get any kind of good numbers. I would venture to say that, you know, probably on Monday morning, you may see a drop because you saw the very harsh selling into the close on Friday. You'll see a bit of a drop because of the fact that you saw Spain asking for some more money, you know, signifying that there is a real need there and a confirmation by Spain itself that they're having difficulty raising money in the open market. And then you may see a bit of a turnaround. I would be aware that in Monday, Tuesday of next week, depending on earnings, you may see a little bit of a pop there. Be careful. It's, in a way, time to think about taking some profits off the table. If you see that, don't get greedy. So many people wait for, oh, I'm just going to wait till I get back to that level, and then I'm going to pull the plug, and then they end up going down, down, down. Then they're going to wait more, and they go down. Don't do that. Be flexible. Don't fall in love. Don't be married to any particular stock. Look at the trend. That's what you need to do. So one of the things I want to talk about, we're going to get to our guest in a second. After we talk with him, I want to talk about some of the earnings and how to follow these and what to be looking for and how we're going to follow those and help you. And then I want to talk about some of the issues when it comes to what to do in this kind of market environment and how to keep on top of that and how to focus in on what's important and not falling in love, but really playing the trend more importantly. Because, yes, it has been a buy-and-hold market for a while, and maybe it will be for a lot longer. But in the meantime, there are sometimes those one stocks or two stocks that are not going to play. Or on the other hand, look what happened on Friday, a big drop, but yet we saw a really nice move on higher volume on Crocs. We sent out a trigger alert to our subscribers. We've talked about this a lot. And by the way, thank you for subscribing. A lot of people are subscribing. And I'm getting some great comments. We're doing real well with that for our calls. High level of accuracy. And, you know, we're going both long and short, depending on the market condition, depending on the stock itself. Yeah, we've seen a lot more short triggers be alerted recently. But it's really great because people are getting these immediate calls to look at, hey, this is a great opportunity. Why don't you think about maybe pulling the trigger at this level? We'll give you all the different levels to short, to go long, to stop out, to add on. We'll talk about that in a second, but because I want to bring this into the earnings discussion. But anyway, I wanted to thank you for all the subscribers and people trials. Trials are now over officially. And if you have an interest, go over to triggerpointresearch.com and check it out. Before we get to our guest, Ed Easterling, as I mentioned, and I haven't talked to him before, but this is because you had written me about some guests to bring on. I wanted to just bring up very, very quickly our great sponsor. And as a matter of fact, I spent this weekend with some people over that work at Citrix, and we got some insight into some of the things they're doing. But GoToMeeting, great, great service, because there's so many applications that you can do with this, whether it's just simply have a meeting, share a meeting, or spend some time sharing some family photos, or, you know, collaborating. GoToMeeting is something that I recommend highly, and they have this new GoToMeeting with HD Faces. It's a simple online meeting service, and you can do it with a group or just one-on-one with somebody, and helps you get better connected to the people you depend on for success. And it is a Citrix product, so it gives you that real good feeling of stability and high-level security. And all you need is a webcam, and you click, and you just start not only collaborating with what's on your screen and sharing different notes and screens and websites and things of that nature, PowerPoint presentations, but you could also instantly have a visual discussion because the other person is on the other side of the camera. So you can start hosting your own face-to-face online meetings today with GoToMeeting.com, and my listeners get 30 days free. Go right now to GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST. I'm sure you're going to like what you see. It's 30 days of absolutely free GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code PODCAST. I'm sure you're going to like it. Let's get to our guest. And you asked for it. I asked you to tell me who you would want to hear on the show, and a few of you wrote in. You asked for Ed Easterling, and he's here with us today. He's the founder and president of Crestmont Holdings in Oregon, and he's not only a money manager, but also research. He does research, obviously, puts out some books. He has some books out called Probable Outcomes, Secular Stock Market Insights, and Unexpected Returns, Understanding Secular Stock Market Cycles. He's got some contributions to some books called Just One Thing. Also worked with John Malden. Lots of research out there, and we're going to talk about some very interesting things with you today, my friend. How are you?
Oh, doing fine.
Well, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it. So you wrote this really interesting piece that you sent over to me, and this is in the beginning of April, and this is the start of earnings season. You know, here is the official quote-unquote start of earnings season, and we have a lot of conversation about, well, is the market fairly valued? Is it overvalued? You know, what's the subtext of what's going to happen in this earnings season? Which, by the way, as a backdrop, I think you would agree, each earnings season recently has been, uh-oh, this is the earnings season that things don't do well, and magically markets react very favorably to analysts, beats of analyst expectations. But let's talk about, you have this whole discussion about the price-earnings ratio, and you talk about what the different components are of different types of P/E ratio, I guess it would be ways of looking at it. So tell me a little bit what your opinion is on current market conditions, earnings expectations, price-earnings ratios, all that good stuff.
Certainly. I think first and foremost, the key is to define, as you just mentioned, the proper measure of market valuation. And price-earnings ratio is a good place to start. There are a variety of different ways to look at P/E ratios. Some look at the current earnings that are being reported today and today's price and come up with a valuation. Others adjust earnings for the earnings cycle because we go through a very volatile earnings cycle that will often send misleading signals. If we're at the peak of an earnings cycle, it makes P/E ratios look low and artificially distorted cheap for the market. If instead we have earnings that have troughed coming out of recessions or just business cycle troughs, it can make the market look expensive just when it's actually cheap. And that's why I prefer to look at a normalized P/E rather than a reported P/E. And today is one of those examples where we have a very low reported P/E, but a fairly high normalized P/E.
Well, let me just ask you this. Let me stop you. For those of us that may be saying, okay, the word normalized, I think I understand what that means. What does that actually mean?
What that means is that we as earnings go through this cycle, they typically go up for several years in a row before declining for a year or two. And so we need some measure. For example, Bob Shiller up at Yale looks at 10 years worth of inflation-adjusted earnings and looks at that for its denominator. That's an old Graham Dodd approach to normalizing earnings. Crestmont uses another approach that looks at the normal relationship between earnings and the economy and normalizes the earnings cycle to be more in line with the consistency of the economic cycle. Both of those provide very similar measures.
Mm-hmm.
What it means is that today, after we've had a tremendous surge in earnings, and we're all reading about record profit margins,
right?
What we're trying to do is to adjust that back a bit to a more normalized level so that when we do have this, when we do have the next downtrend in earnings, we won't get an artificial distortion because of it.
So right now, over the last several quarters, we've seen a consistently better growth rate of earnings. Revenue hasn't been as consistently better. In other words, it's growing, but at a slower pace, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So we're seeing earnings, which obviously means if you have earnings, EPS, earnings per share, moving better than revenues, that means margins have to be better.
Well, that's it. Exactly.
That's a simple calculation. So margins are better because, what are the things? We have employment. A lot of people have really streamlined it. We've talked about many times on this discussion how, as I call it, consumption cannibalism, which is the effect of having robotics, technology, and many of the, I guess we'd call it mid-level and some jobs just totally obliterated from the face of humanity, right? You don't need one of those keyboard receptionists plugging in the various things to move things around anymore. You have unattended. You don't need anybody. You don't need a copy person going up and down the halls with things and a file clerk as much anymore, right? Those are just gone.
The progression of productivity. Absolutely.
So we have productivity, and we have less people working. We have, it seems, I think this is crazy, but no inflation, so the input prices are at least reasonable, at least statistically, I'll put it that way. So that all goes into this margin issue, right?
It does, and I might throw one more in there, and that is that the uncertainty we've had in this environment about the future has slowed the economic growth a bit because we haven't seen a lot of business startups. The normal business cycle is driven by the fact that when margins get high, we bring in new competitors,
mm-hmm.
or the existing competitors become competitive against each other, going after market share. And that tends to drive margins back down. When margins get low, that flushes out the weak competitors and then causes the cycle to head back up again. And that goes back and forth.
But when you look, when
we
you look
may
at,
have seen that some of this uncertainty right now is holding back some of the pressure of competition.
Well, who's going to compete with an Amazon? Seems like Amazon just wiped everybody off the face of the earth.
Absolutely, but the question is whether Amazon's going to be the same leader 10, 20 years down the road.
Okay.
Would there be an emerging Amazon that would bring a different business model?
Right. I guess it would be the concept of Netflix and what happened when a lot of competitors came in there, or maybe even the Apple Music Store, what's happening with Google and Amazon and a variety of other places out there, or simply look at the 8-track tape, I guess, right?
Absolutely. But I think if we'd been having the same conversation back in the 1950s, we would have said, Sears, who's going to ever compete with them?
Yeah, exactly. Now, here's, I think, what is very perplexing, at least to me, and maybe if you're doing the analytics, it's kind of perplexing. How do you account for, when you look at the valuations based on a market? Now, obviously, there's stocks and then there's the market, two different discussions. But when we look at a market and we look at what the prices are and the EPS you have here, about $91, adjusted to 64. But you're looking at the S&P 500 and looking at the price ratio, and you're looking at a 15 times multiple. And on an adjusted basis, you say it's 22. And according to Crestmont, your actual research, you're saying about 21. So it's in there, okay? But how do you adjust for and reconcile when you see that there are prices that are, in terms of ratios, very high, and markets don't care? What does that mean to you?
That means, let's see, and I think that's the, when what we're seeing right now is very similar to what we saw back in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we had record profit margins. We had reported the low PEs, but a market that just couldn't find its way through the new highs,
mm-hmm.
and through the top. And I think the market was beginning to sense that although the reported PE was low, and everyone was calling for the fact the market had plenty of room to go, it was feeling the fact that, margins were getting to the point where they didn't have much room to go. As a matter of fact, they may even revert. I mean, I think something to keep in mind, if you look at the number of years in a row that earnings increase before we have a decline, we've never gone more than 6 years in a row, and that only happened once in history, before we had a decline in earnings. And half of the time, it happens in less than 3 years.
Hmm.
And we've already had 3 years in a row. So we're getting close to the point where maybe the market is sensing that one of the next couple of years is going to actually show a decline in earnings. And when those declines occur, they're usually not just single digits.
Now, was the biggest reason for an increase in margins and the better earnings numbers in terms of the revenues, was the one of the biggest drivers the savings of human capital, in other words, the unemployment rate rising, people laying off people and productivity, was that a big issue in terms of the rise of margins?
I think it was. I know back then, and some of the companies that I hear from, and even some private companies, that there was a real, many of them in late 2008, with all the uncertainty, were having wage reductions and reductions in force. And there was, a more significant drive to reduce costs and labor costs in the face of that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that we've seen, with some of the policies that are in place that have raised the potential cost of labor in the future, I think companies are trying to find other ways to bring on that capacity without bringing back people.
And companies are smart. Let's be honest; they will find a way. Not every company, but the companies that are the leaders, the solid companies that have been here for a long time, good management teams, they are the ones that will figure some of this out. But
and I think they're doing it with the productivity you're talking about, where they look out and they say, if we hire a person, we've got healthcare costs that are going to be rising shortly because of the requirements that are coming up in 2014. We've got other kinds of regulatory and other kinds of costs that raise the cost of effective cost of labor without raising wages. And they say, when those things start happening, we can afford to hire a machine rather than people to dig ditches.
And how much of that will go into your research and say, we should be investing in the companies that make those machines that dig ditches?
And the research that I do is really is big picture market. It's mm-hmm. environmental research rather than climate, rather than tactical or action based research.
Okay,
I leave that to a lot of the other analysts to find the particular sectors or companies to invest in. What I'm really trying to offer up is the climate that we're in and the fact that this secular bear market is well early in its life, and that we're likely to have a decade or longer of below average, choppy, volatile returns.
So when does the secular versus cyclical, explain the difference on how you're looking at cyclical versus cyclical.
Okay. A cyclical market is a market that is driven more by psychology and by normal market volatility. It's what we've gone through the last last 4 years, where we had a big drawdown in the market and then a substantial quick recovery. And those happen fairly frequently in secular markets.
Mm-hmm.
Secular markets are, and secular is a term that means an era or an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm.
A secular market cycle is when the market, when the market's overall valuation level, the PE ratio, goes from either low to high or high to low.
Mm-hmm.
And that's driven by the inflation rate getting bad. And, mm-hmm. and the reason I say inflation rate getting bad is either high inflation or deflation.
Mm-hmm.
So when we go from periods that have relatively low, stable inflation to either high inflation or deflation, PE goes from higher levels down to lower levels. Whenever we fix inflation and bring it back to low, stable levels, then the PE ratio goes from low, often single digits, back to high, which is usually in the 20s. What we've had happen the last 10 years, 12 years, is that after the 1990s, we took P.E. ratios, not just to the normal highs in the 20s, we took it up to the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
That bubble took P.E. to almost double the level it would normally go to. So we spent the last 10 years just working off the hangover.
Mm.
And now we're just getting started, and you just mentioned the numbers a moment ago, 21 and 22, depending upon which measure of normalized P.E. We're starting at relatively high levels, even today.
So when did this...
And that's why the inflation rate, which today, as you also mentioned earlier, which is relatively low, if it stays relatively low, then we should expect P.E. ratios to stay high. It's only when that inflation rate starts picking back up and heads up into the upper single digits, or if we head down into deflation, that we're likely to see P.E. driven down by a half or two-thirds.
Which is essentially how you look at things when you invert the 10-year yield, or for that matter, invert the earnings yield. It depends on how you want to look at it in comparison, because obviously that is directly impacted by inflation.
I think as long as we're talking about a positive inflation environment, that works fine. In other words, we know that interest rates and bond yields, that they tend to go up when we have higher inflation.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to come down when we have lower inflation. So P.E. ratios and bond yields do have that consistent relationship in high inflation. But if we went into deflation, we would actually see P.E. ratios fall because the future earnings, reported earnings, would start declining in deflation.
Mm-hmm.
But the bond yields, like we saw in Japan, would stay real, real low. Matter of fact, would go almost to zero because we're in deflation. So actually, it's the opposite relationship between bonds and stocks in deflation.
Right. So now...
So if you look at... Go ahead.
I was going to ask, just to backtrack for a second, when did, in your opinion, this secular bear market begin?
The year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
We saw, and that was driven by the peak in the P.E. ratio. It peaked in 1999. And then in 2000, we began the decline, and we've been in it since then. So what we're looking at is a general decline in P.E. that went originally from the bubble levels in the 40s, now down back to the 20s, the low 20s.
And when do you say, okay, over, we're in a secular bull market?
That'll occur when a secular bull market is a period where the normal returns that come from dividends and earnings are supplemented with a general increase in valuation. So if we buy a stock at a 10 PE,
mm-hmm.
and then it goes to a 20 PE,
mm-hmm.
that gives us a doubling of our return,
mm-hmm.
even if earnings don't change. If earnings actually go up over that period of time, let's say earnings double, then we get a double on earnings and a double on the PE, we get great returns.
Right.
So the only way to get those above average returns is to get the doubling effect of PEs rising. From where we are today, with PE in the 20s, we can't expect PEs to double or triple. So it's only once the market PE gets down, at least in the low teens, close to 10 or so, could we then turn around and expect for it to be able to double if we got inflation back under control? So what I would look for is, number one, the inflation rate is in bad shape. It's either in high inflation or deflation.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, the price-earnings ratio is somewhere close to 10.
And that would be the, let's say this, that would be the demarcation point of the end of the bear and then turning into the bull.
That is correct. Now, the biggest challenge is knowing in current terms when that's likely to happen.
Yeah, no kidding.
if inflation goes to, we look back at this in 6 or 7 years, inflation's at 8% and P.E. ratios are down at 10 or 11, then we might be asking, well, is this it? And we might turn around the next year and inflation's gotten up to 10 or 11,
mm-hmm.
and P.E. ratios have been pushed down to 6 or 7 or 8. Or the Fed might have gotten under control. So what I think the key point would be, it's not as important to try to time that bottom as it is to recognize that when you invest, when you pay the prices associated with high valuations, you get lower returns. When we're in a position where you can actually then, like we saw in the early 1980s, be buying stocks that have 6%, 5% dividend yields consistently, and we're buying them at 8 or 9 or 10 years' worth of earnings, but then we're set up for what can provide well above average returns.
Right. So, you have like Shiller, who's pretty negative, I think, on things generally. I know you've worked with him on a few things. You have Schilling, different name, who is looking for an 800 on the S&P, which is really kind of, you got to scratch your head on that. I'm not sure what the date is on that. But you know, he's right on that fact that he's invested in long-term T-bills and bonds and all that. But I know that you look at the big picture. Where is in the world, if you've seen this, where in the world is a secular bull market going on?
That's a good question. I tend to focus more on the concepts in the U.S. market because we have such rich data going back over a century.
Right.
The biggest challenge with going over and looking at the Japanese market or looking at the European markets is that most of them only have 50 years of history or so, or some of them even less than that.
Yeah.
And so I think what we want to look for, because the concepts work the same, is other markets where we have, for the bull market, where we have low valuations due to bad inflation conditions and a likelihood that their policies are going to fix inflation, get it back down to low stable levels.
Well, you'd have to kind of start thinking about China then. You'd have to think about it.
Yes. I think the biggest issue with China is the uncertainty whether they can manage that growth into the future. And certainly in China, you have a very rich potential environment. It's whether the legal and social infrastructure is strong enough to support it long term.
Yeah, and then we have to just back this all up and say that the data is probably a little bit suspect anyway. And you know, this question we've always questioned the data in China, saying you know the richest jobs in the world, in terms of government, are in China. And if the government, you make all your money, your wealth beyond means in being in government, then possibly is there any incentive to skew numbers? But we'll leave that to another discussion. So
let me just mention, you know, you mentioned Gary's number earlier, the 800 on the S&P.
Yeah.
That sounds crazy, but remember, he's also looking for deflation.
Yeah, but
on the horizon.
Which is amazing.
On the horizon.
Which is amazing because, I mean, deflation comes from a lot of different reasons, right? There's a little bit of a waiting game going on where people don't want to buy right now because they think prices are going down and all that. We've been seeing prices go up. And on top of that, I think more importantly, the amount of, we'll call it rescue money, resuscitation money, stimulus, quant easing, easy policy, has been extraordinary. I mean, we're talking extraordinary. And I will tell you that it is quite amazing that with all of that money in the system, that there hasn't been any more inflation. Don't you find that mind-boggling?
It seems like right now the tectonic plates of inflation and deflation are so tightly bound, it's hard to imagine that we don't have higher inflation given all the money that's been put in the system. At the same time, with all the deleveraging and other factors, it's also not out of question that we would have deflation. But right now, it feels like they're just tightly bound, and I'm not sure which side it's going to push out on. I'd probably worry more these days about inflation, given everything we're doing. But I agree with you.
Yeah, it is amazing. And then you know you see that the world's markets are so tightly bound that you know a little hint of stimulus and the news is really guilty of this. And I've written many different letters to editors and to reporters. It is absolutely, I think, criminal to continually push the idea that if things go bad, that stimulus will be there. It's almost like all these reporters in cahoots in that, you know, they're looking to save their 401k plans, you know, and it's amazing that no matter what the data is, it seems that we all learned that, hey, if we use the David Tepper concept of if it's bad, it's good, if it's good, it's good, then we can get markets really flying here. And I mean, I think that the first quarter this year, I think you'd agree that earnings were better than expected, and that was good, and economics were better than were anticipated. That's all good, right? I mean, there's a big change there. But
absolutely. But on the horizon, they're beginning to worry a bit about slowing earnings and whether it's just going to be temporary or is this a more significant turn?
So let me throw this out to you. So, yeah, I do see that. There was a 20% increase in earnings expectations for this quarter back in about November, December, and I think they brought that down to about 5 on average. So there's a big drop in expectations from analysts. Now, are analysts just playing a game that they can come way under so that companies will then beat like they've been doing dramatically? I mean, come on, you can't. It is pretty unbelievable how many beats we've seen.
Well, that's true. I think, you know, analysts, obviously, they like to be right. The last few years, they have been underestimating the surge in growth and earnings. They may be, and I think they're better rewarded when they're a little bit under than when they're over. So I think we may be seeing that that there's still a bit of optimism in the analysts.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something we look at is the Economic Surprise Index. I don't know if you ever followed this, but you know, there would be we should figure out how to get a really good earnings surprise index that has a little bit more backing than just above or below, and then trend it, because that would be an interesting thing to take a look at. I don't know if you've ever seen something like that.
I have not, but some sort of a, not just an over-under, but maybe a percentage, just to give us a sense on the,
right,
the magnitude.
And the other thing that, by the way, since we're on the topic, talking about earnings and all that, I would like to see, you know, when you see a company's earnings and you see the P.E. ratios and the earnings numbers of the S&P 500 in total, one thing that's always troubled me is the buybacks, the share buybacks, that there is no adjusted EPS overall that is based on the earnings adjusted for share buybacks. Don't you think that would be good?
I think it would be. Now, we'd need to have that historically going back for many, many years, because everyone likes to make comparisons to long-term averages. And at the same time, we need to recognize that there are certain periods where we have buybacks, but there are other periods where we have net issuances.
But analysts don't necessarily always change their expectations based on the share buybacks, and IBM is the king of this, that a lot of their earnings over the last, I don't know, many, many years has come in through share buybacks. Not that they're doing poorly, but their earnings have come in due to share buybacks, and they're continuing that at an incredible pace. So, you know.
Absolutely.
You know. All right, so what else is going on around the world that has you, you know, looking at, hey, this is interesting to see. I mean, you're looking at the next quarter's earnings that are, again, kicking off now. We saw a number of days ago Alcoa come out. You know, we saw a few, but bigger picture. Are you also considering that we may see a slowdown now? I mean, what's your big picture for the U.S.?
Well, I think, and I would differentiate between the economic conditions and whether we have a slowdown, and the business cycle conditions, which is profitability.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we'll find is that historically, we typically have 1 to 2 recessions, economic pullbacks, per decade.
Yeah.
But we typically have several, if not more, business cycle pullbacks that occur intra-decades, mm-hmm, inside-decades. And so as I look at the economic environment, I see vulnerability, yet I see the chance that, depending upon the policy set that's used, there could be a surge in economic growth upcoming.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I see, because of the historical business cycle and where we are in terms of profitability, that there's a vulnerability that we're going to see a pullback in the earnings cycle. Matter of fact, I wouldn't be surprised to see both of those things happen, that we see a surge in the economy, but a decline in earnings.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the surge in the economy would occur because there's a tremendous amount of pent-up economic potential.
Right.
Because we had such slow economic growth the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
But if the economy started to pick up, companies, in anticipation of that growth in the economy, could very well begin to increase, a step increase in their infrastructure, begin to hire people, begin to compete, to try and capture some of that margin, some of that market share. We could see that there is a compression in margins with a surge in the economy, and I think that'd be a big surprise for the market.
Yeah, I think one of the big things is that a few years ago I said, you know, when I see hiring really pick up, that's when I may get concerned, because if it is such a big part of the overall margin benefit over the last couple of years or months at that time, if we see the reverse is true, that there is a lot of hiring that goes on, then maybe we have to start scratching our head wondering if we're going to see earnings kind of pull back. And then you have to, of course, say, well, if they're hiring, maybe there's a lot more revenue opportunity, and then the margins hold, because, you know, everybody knows that companies are, you know, always going to be held up to whatever their earnings needs to be by the street. So, you know, they're very cognizant of that in this situation. But what about in terms of this fiscal cliff that we have coming up at the end of this year? Do you see a concern there?
Absolutely. And I think the biggest challenge is that we continue to push it off, you know, 6 and 12 months at a time. And that just keeps a lot of uncertainty out there, and that's probably a part of what's holding back overall economic growth, the uncertainty that businesses and startups have about how we are going to address that, or if we're going to address it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess each time we get close to that cliff, I get hopeful that we're going to do something that does more than just push it off for 6 or 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, I think investors generally have gotten the feeling that, you know, there's going to be a perpetual movement into the future of all of this, the debt, the taxes, you know, because of not only presidential election cycle, but because, you know, nobody wants to be the bad guy in this. And we've seen such a significant amount of pushing things under the carpet, off to the side, out of the, you know, out of the face of investors. I mean, just look what happened in Europe. The amount of money that was spent, it was taken as a good thing that, you know, a trillion and change is being utilized to prop up these areas. And what's really great is as soon as you have a bad bond auction over there, you know, it is clear as day that the ECB is coming in. They're allowed to buy the public debt now. So if there's a bad bond auction and you see markets really roll over, they just go in and buy the next one to make sure that everybody's happy. I don't know. I think it's kind of silly.
I agree with you.
I mean, setting the bad stage.
Well, the key to all this is how, and I think for the stock market overall, one kind of comment just for consideration is that if we come at the with our fiscal problems with a more balanced approach, one that that leaves a sufficient amount of capital in the system, then that will enable us to have the more long term solid growth. If we go at this just trying to take money from the sources of capital in the economy, some of the recent proposals we've put on the table, that'll take capital off the table, which would reduce future productivity and growth. The stock market's valuation level is driven by two things, the inflation rate and the future growth rate. If we're moving to a period, a decade or two, where economic growth is going to be closer to 2%,
right,
than 3%, which was the historical average,
mm-hmm,
that has a dramatic effect on price earnings levels.
Hmm.
And we could see the normalized valuation of the market, we could see the market fall by as much as a quarter or more just because of slower growth.
Right. Interesting.
Even without the higher inflation. With higher inflation. So I think, you know, as long as we can avoid deflation and inflation, as long as we can avoid slowing the growth, then 800 on the S&P looks like a sensational number.
Right.
If we did run into deflation or inflation, or if we saw a significant reduction in future growth or series of policies that led us to believe that would occur, then I'm not sure that we couldn't see something below 1,000.
Right, exactly. Well, I'll tell you, then the answer would be, if we want things to continue, really just keep pushing things off and stay with what we're doing, which is pretty much just holding the boat steady, keeping everything level, making sure that nothing, you know, no cracks form, and if there are, we just patch them instead of repairing them, and you know, as long as possible. And that seems to be the way that is going right now. I mean, we have right now a government that can't make a decision on crossing the street together. So, you know, they can't. So, anyway. Ed Easterling, great information, good conversation. CrestmontResearch.com. We'll put your information on the show notes for this show. And maybe you'll come back one day and talk with us some more and see what happens as we see the next quarter's earnings come out.
Look forward to it, Andrew.
Hey, I appreciate it. Have a great day.
All the best.
All right, bye-bye. Ed Easterling, he was, I think, pretty interesting. It's nice to see a different, we have a different voice, different opinion, but also a different aspect of how he looks at markets, a perspective, if you will, and good stuff. All right, I mentioned before we got to Ed that we're going to talk about some of the earnings, and I have a list. It's a pretty long list, but I highlighted some of the important numbers that are going to be coming out, and of course, economics are going to be coming out important, but I want to talk about this. Now, here's something I want you to pay attention to. This is really important. What you're going to see throughout the week coming up, as we see every earnings announcement period, is that you're going to see a lot of, headline numbers, we'll call it, where, this one beat, this one didn't beat, and all that, and then stocks are going to do something either directly that makes sense or make totally nonsense, you know, in terms of their price movement afterwards. Now, one of the things you have to look at is, okay, EPS, yes, and revenues, of course, and expectations and what management thinks in their conversations afterwards on the conference call, blah, blah. But more importantly, I think is what we look at is comparable EPS. We call it CEPS. And that is, what is the comparable when you strip out all the important numbers? What are the analysts we're looking for? Not just the headline number. And that's what really moves things. Now, we use that in our Trigger Point Research reports. It's a different thing than the alerts that you've seen before. These are institutional quality reports. We're going to start putting some of those up this week for you to take a look at. They're very intense. They're very detailed. They have historical information on there. They also have expectations. They kind of blend in the alerts a little bit of what to expect so you can trade the stock actually with a really good edge. But that's not what I really want to talk about per se. I want to talk about what it is that you want to focus in on when it comes to this. And what I see that you want to look at is going to be, you know, this whole headline number, but also wait, be patient before things happen. And you want to look at the comparative EPS. Now, it's hard to get that comparable EPS just off of a free website and all, but we blend it out utilizing what analysts are looking for and stripping it out, like I mentioned. Let's just talk about who's going to be coming up and what I want you to pay attention to from a big picture first, okay? So in the beginning of the week, we have Schwab coming up. And again, these are picks of some of the 91 companies that are going to be reporting. You have Schwab coming up on Monday, and Citigroup as well. Citigroup will be coming out before the market, about 8 o'clock in the morning. The estimate is about $1.02, so keep that in mind. But the big issue is going to be with Schwab. The you know, they're going to probably have to talk about the changing yield curve and the dynamic there, because where they make their money is on their cash on hand, and it's really been very, very difficult for brokerage companies. So they're going to be a big key to the whole brokerage industry. And of course, Citigroup, after you saw the report last week from Wells Fargo and as well from JP, lots of financials coming out. Tuesday, you have Goldman Sachs. We are short Goldman Sachs, as full disclosure. We went short on them on Friday, small position. They're breaking down through a fast zone, as we call it. And we are really close to putting out a trigger point alert on that. We also have IBM coming out. We have Intel coming out. That's all on Tuesday. Intel and IBM will be coming out both after the market, Goldman Sachs before the market. J&J is also coming out, Johnson & Johnson. Intuitive Surgical, that's been really interesting. That's been a wild mover. I put that on my just a screen just to take a look at that. Now, on Wednesday, we have Halliburton. Halliburton's been a disaster area. Halliburton looks like it's basing out. It could be interesting. Abbott Labs, Bank of New York, St. Jude. Qualcomm will be coming out after the hours, after the close on Wednesday. American Express, of course, after close. Yum Brands, we took a look at that. I talked with John Markman, my friend, this week about what's going on with Yum. And boy, they have been just really kicking it. The chicken craze in China is really doing well for them. F5 Networks, we hold a small position there as well. And F5, there was some drop on that over the last week or so. It's a really cool company, but they've had a lot of volatility around their earnings. I'd keep a watch on them because they're really going to be a key player when it comes to all of the cloud computing companies. And, you know, you need to watch those for what's happening and watch them for the big picture between them and IBM and Infosys on what's going to happen in the technology space for earnings. Then we have United Healthcare Group. Freeport Mac is coming out. We'll see what's going on with them in the copper area and in the materials area. That's going to be an important one. And this is all on the 19th. DuPont's coming out, chemical area, very big and very important to look at them and what's going on there. Then you're going to see Bank of America before the market on the 19th, Morgan Stanley before the market on the 19th, Verizon, Chipotle after the market closes, Microsoft after the market closes, SanDisk, Wynn, Nucor for steel, and Peabody, natural gas and coal. That's going to be a really interesting one on Thursday. And Friday, we're going to wrap it up with McDonald's, General Electric, Kimberly-Clark as well will be in there, Johnson Controls for the auto parts and manufacturers area, Robert Half, which is, of course, the company that is involved in staffing, and we're going to see Edwards Life Sciences, which just looks like this chart looks horrible. We're going to put this list actually up on the disciplineinvestor.com. It tells you the time, the date. Tells you the period that they're going to be reporting for, as well as what is the headline estimate, and then we'll do some reporting throughout the week. Stay tuned to that, both on TriggerPointResearch.com as well as the DisciplineInvestor.com, so you can get the CEPS and what we think and some of the reports we'll put out there, just to kind of give you some idea what we're doing for institutions these days and the like. We're going to wrap it up here. We're going to kind of lots coming up next week that we're going to have to really focus in on. And I really wanted to give you an idea of what we're thinking when it comes to earnings and how important that's going to be. This is going to shape the next quarter. Next week, we'll probably start shaping the next quarter when it comes to markets in general, because one-fifth of the S&P will be reporting, and that's enough to give us a real good blend of what to expect. All right, until next week, thanks for joining me. Of course, if you want to check out how we're managing money, what we can do for you, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, go over there and check out the virtual tour. There's a little blue box on the right side that says the Disciplined Investor. Click it, fill out a couple of things, and you can go right to the virtual tour to see how we manage money. And of course, if you haven't done so, I told you this, you really need to at least get 1 month going for a subscription at Trigger Point Research. And I'm sure you'll make your money back very quickly if you follow the way that we're doing things. All right, other than that, I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. It's Andrew Horowitz signing off on this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.